Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, it looks like it is September 28th, 2025, when we're airing this the first time. And we'll probably replay it at some point in the future. But let's see today. Who gets free advertisement of the week this week? We
Holy
haven't actually
cow.
Talked about it.
Yeah, well, this is right off the top.
Uh-huh. I have three.
Do you?
Yeah.
Lay one out there.
Yeah, budget printing.
Budget printing.
Uh-huh. McDonald's printing. Down there on Bocelli, across from the bowling alley and liquor barn. So budget printing. They're amazing. Hartnell Cleaners has been doing an excellent job. We like them a lot. Super reliable. They're obviously on Hartnell.
It's pretty good. It's a good thing they have to change their name.
I know. You can't move. You're screwed. You're forever Hartnell Cleaners. You got to be on Hartnell. You can slide up and down the street, but you can't go anywhere else. That's it. And last but not least, since we just finished moving Bill's mom, we have maybe touched the last moving box for a while. Jeff Thompson at We Move It comes in. He actually comes in first, but we made him third today.
Yeah, he does a great job.
Yeah, he does do a great job. So if you have to move, whether it's close or far, like this was, hour and 70 some miles out of town.
Yeah, it's a 150 mile round trip.
Yep. Yep. Up on the side of Mount Lassen. It was super reasonable. They did a great job.
Yep.
And, the only mishap was, something got unpacked, but it got put in the oven instead of in the cupboards, and took us 3 weeks to figure out it was in the oven.
But no, it's a good place to store things.
So you know. I really need to call Jeff and tell him we found those items. It's kind of funny. Things happen when you move, you know? It's hard. It's mentally draining.
Yeah.
Make mistakes. Oh, my goodness. Well, and our guest the first hour is Brian Reisinger. He has written a book called Land Rich, Cash Poor. We have had him on before, but there was still more to talk about. And then we also heard him on Coast to Coast. How much fun was that? We're like, oh my gosh, he's famous. But he was on with us before he was on with Coast to Coast. He is the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor. Subtitle is My Family's Hope and the Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer. And in all seriousness, if you're not following this type of thing, you're blowing it, and you obviously don't care about food security, national security, all those things. It's a real issue. Brian grew up on a farm in Sauk County, Wisconsin. I remember I checked that out last time. I think I got it right. Lives to tell the hidden stories of rural America. He's a columnist and a consultant, and he worked with his father from the time he could walk before entering the worlds of business, journalism, and public policy. And I'm going to have to update his stuff. It says he's been published in USA Today, Newsweek, Yahoo News, and a bunch of other things. And I need to add on here that he was also on Coast to Coast, because that's fun. That's got a huge audience. They currently live in southern Wisconsin on a farm. Surprise. Brian, kind of did a little snippet of your bio there, but I'm sure we'll get to the rest of it. I just wanted to before we, you know, run out of time this morning, which obviously we're not right now, but before we run out of time, I want to know if wolves are an issue where you are. So we can talk about that at any point. But I just want to put a little bug in your ear about wolves.
Well, I'm so glad you're asking about that. It's good to be back with you, both of you. Wolves are a huge issue.
Okay.
We've got, you know, ranchers and farmers and also loggers who, you know, their livelihoods depend on being able to honestly control the wolf population, because it's such a dangerous thing for livestock and for people working deep in the woods. And, you know, it's really an issue, and the government is keeping us from being able to do that, unfortunately.
Well, we kind of have good news on the federal side. Are wolves, listed as an endangered species by your state?
You're hitting on the exact issue. Of course, there's been the back and forth issue of whether they're going to be delisted federally, and so it's good news on the federal level. At the state level, what we saw was that the state government for a while kind of drug their feet on how's the hunt going to work and how is it going to, you know, and we of course want a good controlled hunt. We want a careful management of all of our resources, right? All outdoorsmen and farmers and everybody care about that. But they really drug their feet and it took a long time. And there's only been actually one hunt. The last time it was delisted, there's only one hunt. And then things swung back the other way. So it's been a mess for a long time. And I know you guys deal with that in your neck of the woods too.
We just had, I had a rancher over in Sierra Valley, lost 85 animals in a very short period of time just on his ranch.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, for all the wolf lovers out there, well, they don't listen to us. I wish they would though. And actually, if they are, please go to wethepeopleradio.us, click on the wolf tab, and I want you to look at the pictures, because those are not pictures of animals that were eaten for food. Those are animals that were tortured and are still alive.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyone who thinks they don't attack for just sport and for teaching their young without actually killing and eating their prey is stupid, actually. Because that's absolutely a thing, and you can see these animals are walking around, and the back end is eaten out. The udders are ripped off. These animals are still alive. You know, it's gruesome and it's grueling for the animals. For all those, you know, for all our animal rights people, it's like you get to a thing like this, and oh, crickets.
Yep.
You got nothing.
That's exactly right. You know, I mean, look, you know, the people who care about animal rights and natural, whatever it may be, environment, whatever reason they have, you know, I say, look, you know, it can be a beautiful animal, but every animal, there's a balance to our ecosystem. And guess what? When you've got domestic animals like cattle who are preyed on by wolves, part of that natural balance is mankind and hunters. You know, hunting
exactly
can be part of having a balanced population, a good ecosystem. Hunters care about the environment just like farmers do. But when you just let, you know, one predatory animal prey on a whole herd of domestic animals without letting the hunter or the rancher or the farmer be part of that natural balance, it's not natural. And there can be all kinds of beauty in nature, and the wolf can be part of that, but only if things are balanced properly.
Well, the other thing, you know, let's face it, like with your dogs at home, I don't care. I mean, I don't think you can train I don't think you can train a guinea pig, but, you know, with all animals, but, you know, a lot of people have dogs and cats and stuff. Even with those animals, you don't give them free run in your house unless, you know, you want to live in a disaster zone. You know, you have to have, you know, rules and boundaries and those kinds of things. And with wolves, we are their apex predator. And, it takes them about 1 second to figure out that they can come onto your property and, you know, snatch your dog out of your backyard. They can eat your cattle right there by your house. Actually, I have a picture on the website of these people's house. The whole front is covered with blood. The front door, the garage door, right on their front porch, two wolves killed an elk in the middle of the night.
Incredible.
I mean, imagine the sound at midnight, you know, with two wolves killing an elk on your front porch.
Well, they've lost all fear of man.
Of course.
I mean, we're not hunting them, and so there's no fear there. So here they come, and they'll come right up on your front porch.
And
well, you guys are getting me deep into history and human nature here, but people who say that, you know, humans are disrupting nature and aren't part of this natural balance, I mean, you know, mankind came out of nature too. Like you said, we were their apex predator for centuries. I mean, you know, there's a balance to everything. And when one link in that chain is suddenly broken, i.e., you know, mankind not playing its role in helping nature's balance as well, you have other predators become overly dominant, and that's what those are doing. They're being allowed to run roughshod, and they're not being subject to any kind of natural check that would be out there in the wilderness normally for the rest of the history of mankind.
Yeah. Well, it's gotten crazy. And, you know, when you look at people, you know, people say, well, mankind is disrupting the animal. Yes, we are, because we are putting unnatural order of things. You know, we've changed the order of things. And when you do that, you make a mess. Like in our area, where the wolves are just completely overpopulating, you don't have the elk population, you don't have the deer, you don't have any of those things. I mean, in on some of these large ranches where the wolves are, you know, you can't follow your animals around on 40,000 acres. I mean, I think there's a misnomer that, oh, why don't they just fence them in and bring them in the barn at night?
Right, exactly.
I read that all the time in comments on Facebook, and I just want to reach through there and teleport them to an actual you know, place where animals live. But before we lose the federal delisting, there was a case in Montana where federal Fish and Wildlife tried to, well, they did delist, and they were sued in Montana, and some Obama judge, and I'm not even just, you know, being, I'm not, I mean, for real, an Obama appointed judge decided, nope, you can't delist them. Not enough science or whatever. And that was right before the Trump administration ended the first time. So that is back in play, has been appealed. And at this point on the federal side, Fish and Wildlife has provided all the current science, and they're just waiting for a court that isn't run by someone who can't read to, I was going to say pull the trigger, but that's probably a little too, yeah, we do want them to do that, though, because it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And it's something where, you know, look, it's not only the natural balance of nature, and we're not only right on all those merits, but you get back to the original point of your question. You got ranchers who are raising homegrown beef for the American people. You got farmers who are raising beef as well as all kinds of other crops, and can't be raising other types of food and fiber if they're losing money on their livestock side, to say nothing of the suffering of the animals that are killed by wolves. But it really is one of those things where a natural balance to what's going on out there, and mankind being part of that, can also support our food industry and really the food that lands on everybody's dinner table, because it's a problem where you guys are in Northern California. It's a problem where I'm from in Wisconsin. It's a problem in all kinds of parts of the country where our natural resources are really important to our entire economy and culture.
Yeah. And what we're seeing here, I'm curious if this is also a factor where you are, if it's just crazy California. But our kind of calculation here is that once the federal delisting is done, and, you know, for all the people that are out there, I can hear you in my head, and you're saying, well, why doesn't Trump just do it? Well, when you do things like that, then when the next administration is, they bring out the big eraser, you know, and they're in power, they get the big eraser, they come back, and you're back to restart it. So we need this to be, you know, legit, legal, full of science, and make it really hard to relist them. But once that's done, we're really hoping that the pressure lies, you know, hits the state like a ton of bricks, and they're forced to make a decision. Do you think that's possible where you are?
Yeah, I think it is, and you're absolutely right. We need the federal steps taken, done the right way, in a way that, you know, is durable. That's the way I think about what you're talking about. It doesn't flip-flop back and forth. Let it be durable. And I think, you know, in Wisconsin, there's divided government. There's a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. And
how nice, you have options.
You know, and so I think there's a world where there will be some pressure in that direction. And, you know, I have a little bit of a unique chance to look at this and other issues, because I go back and forth between the farm in Wisconsin and then my wife's family, which is from California. And so we spend time in part of our time in Sacramento as well. And, you know, I see the difference between the different state environments as far as how they treat their farmers and things like that. It's kind of tough everywhere. But this issue is another example where, boy, I really hope that when the federal steps are taken, the states feel pressure to handle things the right way. Because the one thing I'll say is, even, you know, whatever the state government is, no matter how right or left it is or whatever, you know, a state has more pressure than the federal government to be responsive to its people locally. And so I really hope that can happen in both Wisconsin and California. I know it's probably tougher in California, but still, people need to hear. State government needs to hear from people about how damaging and challenging of an issue this is.
Yeah. The thing that has actually just hit, I've got to add this article to our Wolf page, but Colorado's going after Oregon because they relocated some wolves that were a problem because that's what we should do with problems is relocate them because it makes everything better. It works with children and dogs, right? You just relocate them. They'll act better. So they moved them to Colorado, and then they found out they had hydatid disease. Surprise.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, that's the part that the public should be concerned about. If you're out in the woods and maybe they don't chase you around, but if you interact with those parasites and bring them home, you're likely going to, you know, kill your own dog.
Oh, that's absolutely right. It's absolutely right. You know, the danger of the contact that can occur, but then there's other things like this that, you know, people need to be aware of the impact of things. And that's why I think it's so important for these issues to be kind of pulled out of that partisan political frame where,
yeah,
you know, half the people think one way, half the people think the other way. Just, you know, and the people who think the wolf just needs to be protected endlessly, it's really politics. It's not the facts and the science and the real impact on life. And so I think it's good for people to know all those real issues that, you know, not wanting your family or your dog to be infected, not wanting an innocent animal to be killed by a predator. These are not political issues, you know?
No. And besides that, I mean, okay, so you don't have a dog, so you don't care if you went hiking in the woods and brought back a parasite, so it's not going to kill your dog. Maybe you don't eat beef. Okay, so you're a beef hater. All those kinds of things, it's still going to cost you. I mean, this ultimately comes back to an issue with our taxation. You're running agencies that are trying to manage these, doing a bad job, and all getting paid for it. Oops.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, it goes back to the point you were making about the photos and the gruesome photos. I mean, I know a lot of people who don't eat meat, and I respect them, and they respect me, even though I grew up with part of our livelihood being raising animals, you know, to each their own. But a lot of people who don't eat meat, you know, it might come out of a conviction about animals not being harmed. Well, the wolf doesn't share that perspective. I hate to say it.
Yeah, right. Besides the fact that the things that, I mean, if you drive a car, there are cattle byproduct in tires.
That's right.
I mean, it's in everything. So if you don't eat meat, that's real nice, but why don't you look at what the stuff that you do use, and it does intersect with the cattle industry. Absolutely intersects. I do have a list about that. I should post that list. We have to take a really quick break. So, sorry, Brian. When we come back, we can talk about whatever you want.
That's great. I'm having a great time.
I was kind of on a wolf jag this week again. 85 animals. I was like, they kind of made my head explode. So, just in case people weren't paying attention, you're listening to We the People. You can find all sorts of information at wethepeopleradio.us.
Ow! Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood.
Where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
That's what it's supposed to be like out on your ranch. I've always been tempted to have other noises in the background, but I don't do it because it's a nice song we remember from our childhood. And when people think about growing up on a farm, living on a ranch, that's what they think of, home on the range, right? Yeah. So, back to Home on the Range with Brian Reisinger. What are we into these days? We haven't spoken with you in like a couple of months.
Yeah, you know, the thing that I'm so focused on, and I'm happy to talk about anything affecting our farms and our food and anything else with you guys, the thing that I'm so focused on right now is the threat that China is posing to our family farms, and really to the American public in so many ways. The most recent example of it is the way that they are kind of firing at United States farmers, at American farmers, in the trade dispute, and the way that China is treating American farmers, but also the bigger, broader issues, the way they've been buying up farmland, as you know, for quite a while, and they're very patient, and the amount of farmland that is owned by foreign countries doubling in 2 years. So all these ways that China is really working, honestly, to destabilize the American farmer, and in doing so, destabilize the American food supply, not yes. only helping to make it more expensive and less healthy, but less secure, you know. And somebody said to me the other day, you know, you think we hate depending upon foreign oil. Imagine what it'll be like when we depend on foreign food. And I think China is striking at the heart of that issue and trying to make that happen, and they're very patient.
Yeah, they are. And anybody who thinks that won't be a big deal, they might hearken back. It's been a little bit now, but remember we had all the dogs that got killed from the Chinese dog food? I don't think people knew it was being made in China, but it turns out that it was, and killed a bunch of people's pets.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there are so many ways they are our enemy. I mean, they've been, I mean, even before you get into the farm issues, the way that they've been buying up government debt, you know, any way that they can try to get their hands on, you know, American freedom, they will do.
Yeah.
That they're working to destabilize our food supply, really, it's the most basic form of security. And, you know, when we get into the issues of why our farmers are disappearing in the book, and when we tell our personal stories of survival for the last 100 years in my family, I think about all the things that the American farmer has withstood to the benefit of the American people. And, boy, it'd be a shame to not pay attention to what China's doing right now and undo all of that resilience.
Well, that is the thing, because foods, when you can no longer feed the people in your country, and I hate to break it to them, but we're not going to, you know, we're not going to be able to sustain ourselves on crickets and stuff like these guys want us to.
We're not going to eat crickets on a stick?
Probably not, although you do have a scorpion inside a candy sucker that was given to us as a joke by a family member, which apparently they sell in a real store to put in your mouth, which makes no sense to me, but... And we did have a dog. We did have a small schnauzer who got hooked on some sort of...
Grasshoppers.
Grasshoppers. That was it out in the backyard. He blew up like a balloon. I took him to the vet. I'm like, what is happening? Our dog is a total fatty. And they're like, well, cut back on the food. Like, we've done that. Turned out, yeah, he was eating grasshoppers, turning into a blimp.
They were nice.
So just
they were crunchy.
In case anybody thinks you're gonna trim your waistline by eating grasshoppers, I got a hot tip for you. It'll blow you up like that Hindenburg. Not good.
Well, it is kind of scary if you think about it. If our country, you know, got to a point where we were totally dependent on foreign food, how quickly could that be shut off? And you'll see famine in this country, which, you know, you start destroying the local farms. They, you know, when famine does hit, you don't just fire them back up and put food back on the shelves. It takes a while to refill the pipeline and get the production going. And, you know, that doesn't happen overnight. You know, we see that with the logging industry. I mean, all these mills have shut down because of export laws that have changed. And once these mills shut down, you don't start them right back up again because they are dismantled, they are sold off, and it takes millions of dollars to get them put back together and get back online, and that takes a while. So here we are talking about our food supply. I think that's pretty important topic. I think we need to really protect our own. So
we used to love farmers, Brian. I mean, farmers were like nobody, but we used to like police too, I guess. So maybe why do I ask why? Where do you think this comes from?
Yeah, you know, of what the American farmer represents. And first, it was in pursuit of cheap food, which, you know, is a good goal, but it can't be the only goal, right? And we were pursuing cheap food and other things that we could have pursued that in a way that preserved more family farms. And We didn't. We made, you know, economic, political, and technological decisions that meant we were going to wipe out farms for 45,000 a year. And now, they're still. The belief by a lot of people who don't appreciate our farmers anymore is that, well, all the small farms are gone, and it's just the big farms and what have you. Well, you know, first of all, you know, all the farms that are still here that are bigger got bigger resisting that get bigger, get out. They got bigger trying to survive. The farms that didn't make it got wiped out by those same forces. But here's the thing that people miss when they think that they don't need to worry about the American farm anymore. We have nearly 2 million farms in this country still. 88% of them are small family farms, and they're out there surviving, as you guys know, because it happens in Redding and Shasta County. They're working multiple jobs. They're working a construction site or pulling a factory shift and working their farm. So the people who think, you know, the family farm is gone, it's just the big farms that they don't care about, whether they're right or wrong to care about that or not, they think that the family farm is gone. We've wiped out most of them. We've wiped out 70% of them, but we still have nearly 2 million left. And jobs to try to help feed our country. What's going to happen is we're going to lose the rest of our farms in the next 40 years. We're actually on track. If we lose farms going forward at the same rate we have for the past century, we will lose them within the next generation. And so people who think the farmer, the American farmer they were once proud of is gone, well, that farmer will be gone if we don't recognize that we've got to do something about this.
Well, you know, another thing that people I don't think realize is we do export a lot of food to third world countries. And if we can't feed our own, that food's not going to get exported. We're going to consume it ourselves, and people are going to starve to death in other countries.
Yeah, that's right.
They got to think about that.
That's right. The way it should work is we should be relying on the American family farmer to supply our support our excess, and we can feed ourselves and help feed the world. And what we're actually doing in this country is we're getting it backwards. It's kind of crazy. While we're wiping out 45,000 farms a year, at the same time we're doing that, we're actually, I use this number because it was at the end of the Biden administration, beginning of the Trump administration, so it's like I tell people I'm not being political here. There was a $42.5 billion ag trade deficit that we had in this country, meaning we were importing $42.5 billion more dollars of food than we were exporting. So basically what we're doing is we're wiping out our domestic food supply by losing farms at 45,000 a year. We're importing more food than ever. And so we're more and more dependent on foreign countries to feed us when it should be exactly what you just said, Bill. We should be supplying our country first and then supplying the rest of the world. And we can do that, but we've got some things backward that, you know, wiping out your domestic food supply and depending upon foreign adversaries, that reads like a doomsday thriller novel. I mean, it's really crazy. This is the reality.
Yeah, and there's no, you know, that point that Bill brought up about the timber industry is absolutely applicable to farming because there's nobody whose industry is crushed who decides later, well, let's go back and do that over again so that I can be the second wave of getting crushed. And besides that, you're a generational family farm. You know, I mean, if you just today decided to go start a farm, you don't have a skill set for that.
Yep. That's right. You know, look, logging, farming, all these industries, a lot of these natural resource industries are the same where if you wipe them out, as you say, number one, people are going to look at that and say, well, that industry died. We can't go that direction. But even if they do try to, let's say they've got an idea and they say, you know what, I can reinvigorate farming, I can reinvigorate ranching, I can reinvigorate logging. You know, it costs so much money to get started again. The land has gone fallow. You got to work the land to get it into good shape. If there were animals, they were sold or slaughtered or whatever, and it takes a couple years. Even if you start out with a couple calves, you know, I mean, it takes a couple years to get a herd going, right? And
right.
So, like, you can't just turn it off and on like that. You wipe it out, it's devastating, and it may never come back.
Well, we see that with, you know, the nut growers and all that. Trees just don't end up big enough to produce a crop. I mean, they've got to grow. It takes time.
Yeah.
And that's an educated process where you cut down these old trees, you put in some new ones, you move these over because you still have enough to produce. I mean, you have to know some stuff in order to pull that off.
Yep. Yep, and it takes time and it takes money. And our farmers all of all kinds already have tight enough margins. They don't have a whole lot of money to gamble with. So if we keep wiping them out, we can't expect to be.
No, we can't. We can't expect. And so then people get all upset, you know, about the. Let's just say it. The farm bill, right? Everybody freaks out when they see the price tag on the farm bill. And the part that they don't remember or know, I guess I'm going to stick with no, maybe not remember, is that 80% of it is food stamps. They're constantly saying, oh, farmers, they're just welfare farmers. My gosh, it just makes me insane.
Well, and the other thing, too, I mean, like you said, 80% of it is, I mean, we need more farm in the farm bill. You know, like, let's take that 20% of the farm bill that's farm programs. Well, here's what's happening. I mean, you know, people who care about our tax dollars and our people who want to be fiscally responsible and stuff like that, I don't blame taxpayers who understand that the farm bill, farm portion, that farm bill is smaller, but still say, hey, where's my money going? Here's where we're at. We're in a world where the taxpayer can ask, where's my money going? And the family farm supposed to be there. And the reason for that is because we've been piling up government programs for 70 years now, decade after decade.
Yeah.
And nobody has done the hard work of saying which programs are working, which programs aren't, which programs are contradictory to each other, which programs have become prone to favoritism and abuse. What we need is Congress to roll up its sleeves, pass a long-term farm bill so that the industry can have some stability and begin to build itself back. But then also, let's have a bipartisan family farm moonshot. Let's have the and the ones that are, make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, because I can tell you, it's not your average small family farmer getting rich off the taxpayer. The taxpayer's money is going out the door, and the average small family farmer is looking around trying to figure out how they're going to make it, and the programs are not doing what they're supposed to.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, too, people get all upset about subsidies, which were taken out of the farm bill in, I don't know, 2014, maybe?
Yeah.
It was quite a while ago. Now it's insurance. It's an insurance program. But also, you know, the other thing people who don't deal in ag need to know is that rice and grains and lots of different crops, we sell to foreign countries. So somebody has to buy it from the farmer. If we're going to give it away, like, you know, we give it to these places that are impoverished and starving, well, that's good, but you can't expect the farmer to work all year for a crop and then just, here you go.
That's right. That's right. You know, every farmer, no farmer wants a handout. Every farmer wants to just be able to grow somewhere they can make a dollar selling it so they can keep their farm going and they can feed their fellow man, and that's the basic truth. And when you get into the issue of these government programs and how they're working and stuff like that, the reality is that we need to be able to, as you say, be able to sell the food somewhere and have the support needed for, you know. Oh, and here's the other thing. If you stall out the farm bill, whatever you think of those government programs, and farmers have a whole bunch of things they do to tighten them down, I can tell you that. But whatever you do, if you don't pass a farm bill, it's also hard for farmers to just get basic lending that they need. You know, a lot of farms have to take out an operating loan in the spring, right? Plant their crop and gamble that it's going to pay off in the fall so they can pay off that loan. And when you don't have a long-term farm bill, lenders in the agriculture space look around and say, hey, I don't know what kind of industry we're going to have here. All that uncertainty keeps agriculture lenders from being able to lend to the farmer the way they ought to. So people who know what it's like to need to have a mortgage to buy your home or a loan to be able to finance your car or whatever, imagine if the government just had a bill that was supposed to be passed that they just never passed. They kept kicking the can down the road, and you couldn't get the loan you needed for your car or your home. That's the situation the farmer is in each spring.
Yeah, well, that's where Secure Rural Schools is right now. You know, we've taken away this land and made it public land, because we don't say federal land here, because it's not federal land. It is public land owned by the public, managed by the federal government. And so everyone who says federal land, you should go right now, wash your mouth out with soap, because we have to take a commercial break. I'm going to give you 2 minutes to go do that, and then you'll never say it again. At least that was my father's theory. Use Irish Spring, actually. I can tell you for sure you'll never say it again. You are listening to We the People. We're coming back with Brian Reisinger, author of Land Rich, Cash Poor. We're here at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
A sweet old lady was 84 when her kin folks came for a month or more. Now from overwork, she's on the other shore. Much too late was y'all come back. And it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, visitors and fish smell after 3 days. Our leader was a silver-tongued man. He deceived the people of the land. And when he got caught, he couldn't stand. It's a little off beat and a little off track. But it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, in rivers and bad government, the lightest things float to the top.
A couple guys in first class on a flight from New York to Los Angeles, kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendants. 30,000 feet above could be Oklahoma. Just a bunch of square cornfields and wheat farms, man, it all looks the same. Miles and miles of back roads and highways connecting little towns with funny names. Who'd want to live down there in the middle of nowhere? They've never drove through Indiana. Met the man who plowed that earth, planted that seed, busted his ass for you and me. You're caught a harvest moon in Kansas. They'd understand why God made those flyover states.
Because that's where our food comes from. So if your parents were not like my parents and didn't drive you across the country every summer so you could see the country, it's really just to visit the relatives on the other side of the country, and we had no money, so we drove and camped. But we did go through all of those states, and we have seen miles of corn and miles of wheat. And if you've never seen the actual amber waves of grain, you know, miles of wheat blowing in the wind, it's unbelievable. You should do that for your children.
Mm-hmm. And keep in mind that somebody has to go out there and...
somebody planted all that.
Planted all
that
and harvested all that. And it takes a whole industry to support that. And as it dries up, those other industries dry up as well.
Wow.
So, and they don't come back overnight either.
No, you're right. So Brian, is Brian in the cone of silence?
No.
Oh, there you
yes.
are. Yes. I know, are you getting Kleenex? That song always makes me sad, but I really like it.
I do too.
It kind of makes me angry, but then it makes me sad, because I realize people do say that all the time. They say that here, and you don't fly over it. You know, it's just, they don't know what they're looking at, I guess.
That's right. Well, and your guys' point about those amber waves of grain, I mean, it is a beautiful thing to drive through, and there are real people living that life. And
yeah, as kids, we looked at that.
And I'm sorry. You know, I'm in a rural area, and so I thought I was in a good spot. I'm sorry.
It's all right. We had that last time. I mistook your dead air for stop talking.
Well, but you're right that it's an industry where real people are living and working that life, and it is necessary for all the small businesses and all those communities, but also for the food on it. And the idea that our food comes from a store, you know, and it doesn't. It gets to a store after it comes from a field that someone worked.
Yep. There's quite a bit that goes to it. I mean, your farm, what do you guys produce?
Yeah, we grow beef. We raise beef for consumers, and then we also raise dairy cows for other dairy herds, and then we also cash crop corn, soybeans.
Drats.
Uh-oh. I think that was
That's
big
a
one.
Long pause.
Uh-oh. Can you guys hear me?
There we go.
Yeah, you're back now.
So we had soybeans, and then the soybeans stole the show. We had a moment of silence for soybeans.
Well, maybe that's appropriate. But, you know, corn, soybeans, wheat, and then we're always experimenting with new types of cash crops. We're doing pasture-raised eggs and chick.
Oh. Mm. Wow. Whatever the pauses were in the first part were much shorter.
Yeah,
than the
I think wherever you moved to is twice as bad as where you were.
So. I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to get back to the better spot. I'm sorry for this.
No, that's all right.
What happens, I guess, when you talk to a farm family. But I'll be – give me 1 second. I'm here. I think it should be better now.
That's okay. I have this all the time. I wind up talking to people for work, and I'm going up the highway, and it's like, okay – I'm almost at the Dog Creek Road sign. As soon as I can see it, it's going to cut off, so I'll call you back. Click.
Exactly.
The worst.
Yeah. Hey, Brian, I'm curious. You know, we talk about how farmland is slowly going away. Do you know what the number is for how much farmland in the country is being gobbled up by, you know, city expansion and development?
Solar farms.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things taking farmland out of production, but I'm curious. I know a lot of it is just going fallow for different reasons, but
right.
What about development?
It's a good question. Urban sprawl was one of the first things that really impacted farmland for a long time, from the 1920s when we started losing our farms to, say, the 1950s and 60s, we were losing farms, but we weren't losing farmland. Farm was still pretty small. And in the 50s and 60s, we started having airports and big cities and urban sprawl as our economy shifted from rural to urban, really started to have an impact. And that's still the biggest impact on farmland. The biggest one is still urban development. Nowadays, it's a wide mix of things, to your point. It's urban development. It's farms consolidating. It's land falling fallow because one farm went under, or what have you. It's a whole, you know, it's so unfortunate because America is such a land of incredible land and natural resources. And for us to be not using it wisely is just so tragic.
Yeah. And another example of that here in California is when we went through the drought years, a lot of land went fallow because there was no water, and so we saw orchards and row crops and all sorts of things just go away. And, you know, a lot of that hasn't come back.
Well, because we had the water, but we consistently in the state of California take 50% of our water and flush it out to the ocean.
Yeah, that's true.
So we take it away from the farmers who are producing something that we care about, and we flush it out to the ocean because we're obviously just, I don't know, at some point, we're either just incredibly destructive ideologues or we're stupid. And I'm not, you know, I guess I'd probably spread my bet out on that.
You know, and that goes back to kind of the point you were making with the wolves at the beginning of this show, which is, you know, look, if you care about our natural resources, you care about water, soil, animals, whatever you care about, you gotta, if you want to fix those issues, you gotta work with people who know about those things and care about those things. And farmers care about abundant supplies of clean water and healthy soil. And you gotta, if the farmer had an environmental crowd that was willing to work with them, people who care about the environment were willing to work with farm conservation problems by working together rather than having it be a divisive political debate.
Well, because they get these weird ideas. Do they do this out where you are? They get these weird ideas that instead of flood irrigating, that they should have these, you know, pivots and the tiny little sprinkly situation. And in a lot of cases, the flood irrigation, the water sits on the ground, it soaks down into the water table, it waters the crop, it does all sorts of good things for the aquifer. But the water that's run through, like, the equivalent of a sprinkler, for instance, a ton of it evaporates. And it never gets soaked into the ground. Then suddenly, oh, our aquifers are depleted. Well, gee whiz, I wonder how that happened.
Yeah.
Like, do you guys have that, too? Do you guys have these stupid things? And okay, so for all the people who say, well, I don't know anything about that, and I don't care. Oh, by the way, you paid for it.
That's right.
Because all those programs come from your tax dollars.
That's right. Everybody's tax dollars is going toward those things that aren't working right. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, if we want to use our water wisely, use it for purposes that help us all, and then be able to recirculate that resource, we ought to be brainstorming and getting together and collaborating with the American farmer to be able to do that. And there are so many things we could do. I mean, the issue with the water being flushed out of the ocean, you're exactly right. You know, there's a lot of rivers in this country that would benefit from having a proper still flow naturally, but it can also provide power. It can also provide lakes for recreation. It can also provide the ability. There are parts of California and other parts of the country where you get too much water one part of the year and not enough water another part of the year. Well, why wouldn't we want to have infrastructure that would be able to help us, you know, dam up and pool that water so that the river can be useful all year round?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And they don't work together. That's the problem. I know here several years ago, I believe it was UC Davis had a program where they were claiming that the farmers were using old technology and using backwards means of growing crops. And they had a program where they were going to go out and farm a test section of land the new way, the new technologically advanced way, and show that, you know, they could do it differently and make it much more productive. That lasted about a year, and two things happened. Number one, they realized it was a hell of a lot more work planting a crop.
Two thumbs down.
Yeah, this isn't exactly what they had in mind. And then they found out that, you know, what the farmers were doing was very efficient and did work. And they were willing to put in the hours and get it done. And so that program just kind of dried up and went away.
Yeah, because did they create a moonscape?
They didn't create anything.
What their farm looked like.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, we've created the surface of the moon.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's farmers are stewards of the land no matter what they say. Oh, they're out there, you know, they're ruining the land and they're overproducing. And
who has a family farm for 100 years who ruins the land, right?
Exactly.
That's a slow burn.
That? Yeah, that's
right.
Not true.
So
today, by not taking care of the land.
So what's one thing that you wind up talking about a lot that people are kind of, well, okay, we've already established people are kind of dopey about a lot of these little things here. But if you were going to be, you know, parachuted into a city and you were going to start somewhere, like, okay, city folks who have never driven out of town and, you know, your whole life is around your Metro card and your Instagram account, What would you start with for those folks?
The first thing that I would want to do is honestly just, I wish I could transform them back to the farm and have them get up with us in the morning.
Oh, there you go.
Let them see,
yeah. Field trip.
You know, let them, exactly. And to Bill's point, let them see the work, mm-hmm. but also let them see the beauty of it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of hardship in this way of life, and we write about that in the book all across our 100 years, and there's a lot of, but there's also a lot of beauty to it. You know, seeing the sun come up, you know, my dad sending the dog out to a baby calf be born, and they could see the hard work with it. They could also see the love of the land and of the animals that go into it. And to me, I think that's the kind of thing that really changes people's perspective, you know?
Yeah, they've got to see it. They don't necessarily have to live it, but they have to go out and see how it's done, see the techniques and the way it's all put together, and it's like an orchestra, you know. Certain things have to happen at certain times, and harvests have to come off on certain days, and it doesn't all happen by accident. It's
That's
all
right.
Very well planned. I know out here, I'm sure it's the same everywhere, when you grow a big crop, it's typically a contracted crop. You arrive at a price before it ever goes in the ground, and you arrive at a date for harvest so that everybody that's growing doesn't show up at the processing plant or the dryer or whatever all on the same day dropping their crops off, because it doesn't work that way. Everybody has to kind of orchestrate their harvests so that it all comes in a timely manner, and that's all part of the program. And I just don't think people really realize the work and the planning that goes into growing a crop.
Well, and what goes into that too fits so well with what you're saying, Bill, is just the cycle of weather that can bless time, or a good, beautiful, sunny day can mean in terms of being able to get your crop in, and what rain at the wrong time or a hailstorm or a tornado can do to an entire family's livelihood, you know. And,
yeah.
You know, come along with a farmer for a corn or soybean harvest and see what they got to do to get that harvest done at just the right time for just the right moisture level, and see what it's like when the wrong weather is bearing down. It'll give you a whole new appreciation for what it takes to feed our country.
Oh yeah, yeah. Same thing with rice. Rice, if you you plant a rice crop, you know, they think, oh, it's ripe, go out and cut it. Nope. You have to wait for the moisture to be just right, and if it's not, you can't cut it.
Bill worked in rice for like 3 years. Yeah, Bill's smart about rice.
Yeah, so you have to wait until the conditions are right, and then you go out and harvest. And I just don't think people know anything about it.
They don't. And we've got 20 seconds left to say goodbye to Brian. Before we just cut him off like we did last time, we thought we'd kind of be a little more, you know, polished about it. So our guest is Brian Reisinger. And his book is Land Rich, Cash Poor. You should get it.
It's so good to be with you guys. We just had the paperback edition of Land Rich, Cash Poor come out. It's available on Amazon, anywhere else online, also bookstores nationwide. And it's available in Reading at Shop Around the Corner Books in downtown Reading as well.
Nice.
It's a great little independent business.
Go get it. We're going to go out with Hungry Like a Wolf. Coming back, Troy Payne, our veteran service officer. Thanks, Brian. Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill.
Aaron.
So the first hour we chatted with Brian Reisinger, talking about family farms. So if you missed that, we also had a little chat about wolves. It prompted somebody to call us that we haven't heard from in many years. But it's always good to know he's still listening. Super fun. This hour, our guest is Troy Payne. And Troy is somebody that I see a lot, but we've never done radio. And I don't know why that is. That's really dumb. Why did we not do that?
I don't know. It's your show.
Good answer.
Way to blame. Right at the beginning, Troy.
Throw down.
Right at the beginning. Knife in the back. So the Veterans Service Office is probably in a county near you. And I realize that it's something I deal with a lot, but we have a lot of people out there who either don't know how it works. They might be veterans. They might not. I have, you know, you have people who know veterans and want to make sure that they get accurate information and claims for benefits. So we thought, gee whiz, let's have Troy come in and educate us on this. So let's see. Hold on here, Troy. I know some things about you. I didn't actually get your bio, by the way, but I did steal it from online.
Oh, well, that's scary.
From the county website, though, so I figured it was pretty accurate. Well, I don't know. Maybe that is scary.
I thought you were going to say the post office.
No.
No, I had those taken down.
You had those taken down. Okay.
Yeah. It was a guy on the street. So you're a Shasta County native.
Yes, ma'am.
So we blame Shasta County for anything that goes wrong here. Since Bill and I are not Shasta County natives, thank goodness. But you were raised in Reading and Anderson. Those are the only two towns I've lived in Shasta County. So maybe we're sort of traveling the same roads here. After graduating from Anderson High School in 1988, he joined the U.S. Army. So we just outed you on your age. So he graduated in 1988. So you're roughly 10 years younger than I am. Joined the U.S. Army. We want to know why that happened, where you served as a military police officer with postings in Texas, Germany, and Georgia.
That is all accurate.
Yeah. So did you, just out of curiosity, it seems like a long way to get to Georgia to go to Germany first. That seems like.
I took the scenic route.
Yeah. Seems like a kind of a circular tour there. And I was honorably discharged in 1995, which is always important, and returned home to pursue studies in administration of justice at Shasta College. Joined the County Veterans Service Office in 2015, so roughly 10 years ago, and now is the County Veterans Service Officer.
That is all accurate.
So I did not put in here what it is you do or any of those good things, so I thought maybe we start at the beginning, eh?
I can do that.
All right. Hit it, Troy.
First, I'd like to just say it's nice that we have an actual veteran running the veteran service office.
Yes, that is super important.
Yeah.
And it's extra nice you're actually here in the studio, so you any unnecessary silences is us with our hand over Troy's mouth, but mostly we won't be doing that.
You know me so well.
And the hijinks continue. No, but seriously, so if you were going to do the elevator speech on someone says, well, what do you do for a living? Like, what would you tell them?
Well, the first thing I want to touch on is what Bill just said.
Oh, sure. Go back
about, about it being nice that it's actually a veteran running the office.
Yes, that's true.
Here in California, that's a requirement. So the veteran service officer for each county has a regulatory mandate to be a veteran themselves.
Great.
Now, the veteran services representatives.
So staff of.
Staff of.
Yes.
Do not necessarily have to be veterans.
Okay.
But fortunately here in Shasta County, our board and our leadership really back the fact that all of our veteran service representatives are veterans. We only have two non-veteran support staff members in our office out of the eight that are employed.
Right. Nice.
Well, it just makes sense. I mean, you have to be able to relate to what's coming your way.
Correct. And that's one of the biggest questions that we get when somebody brand new walks in the office is, are you a veteran?
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
They ask you.
Yeah, we hear that quite a bit.
Well, they want to make sure they don't have to reinvent the wheel and explain.
Yeah, a lot of them want to set the stage for, you know, their understanding or the representative understanding where they're coming from.
Right.
So fortunately for us, we've got three of the five branches represented in our office. And over the years that I've been there, we've had all but the Coast Guard that's been represented in our office. I don't know that we've had in my tenure, we've not had any Coasties, but.
And if we were going to do little known facts, the thing that is often misunderstood is that you are employees of the county.
That is correct.
It is a county office. This is not the VA.
Correct.
You are not the VA, although you process VA claims for benefits.
That's correct. We are accredited and we are vetted by the VA in order to have access to VA systems so that we can track those claims while they're burning at the VA.
That's languishing, I believe, is the word we want to use.
So back to your original question, Aaron, and I appreciate that. Our office is focused on veterans benefits. Our primary mission is veterans disability and pension claims. Those claims that have revenue to that veteran from the federal government. But we are also there to advise on education benefits, dependent education benefits, healthcare benefits, home loan benefits, you name it. We've got the access to be able to explain that stuff.
So you're pretty much first point of contact for a veteran. If he has an issue, he goes to you or does
yes.
he go directly to a veteran's office that's run by the government?
No, I would recommend that any veteran that's having any type of questions, I won't even call them issues because a lot of them aren't. They're just lack of knowledge questions.
Right.
Come down to go see your local VSO wherever you are. If you're here in Shasta County, come
veteran
see us.
Veteran service officer for the we should say that at the beginning. VSOs are veteran service officers.
Yeah. Go see your veteran service office. And at least get your questions answered because that person should be able to give you some food for thought and be able to fill in those gaps that you've got questions about or other angles of those questions that you may not even have thought of.
Mm-hmm. Do you actually help them fill out forms and paperwork?
We actually do it for them.
You do it for them?
Absolutely. Okay. We've got everything. We run on a system in California that is a statewide system. It's developed by a company called Panasoft. And once that veteran has been registered in that system, there's a little bit of delay, but they can be they can be transferred to any county. So as long as they stay within California, any California county that they now reside in can get access to everything that the previous county did for them.
Oh, okay. That's fun.
Absolutely. Right. And that's a time saver. Correct. That is run through CalVet, California Department of Veterans Affairs, contracts with this company in order to do that. Okay. So that makes it really almost seamlessly, they're able to transition from, say, Shasta County and they move to Kern County. Kern County just notifies Shasta County that, hey, this veteran now resides down here. Can we please transfer those files? We contact Panasoft, let them know of the relocation. They flip a couple of switches behind the scene, and now Kern County has access to everything that we did in Shasta County.
Now, what's the difference between what you do and what a Department of Veterans Affairs does?
So there really isn't a huge difference as far as the claims representatives that work for VA. We all have the same duties, if you will. Mm-hmm. However, within California, with the massive population of veterans that we have, there are only three district offices for VA in the state. There's one in Oakland, one in LA, and one in San Diego.
Oh, wow.
So those more rural counties, rural areas throughout the state, if they wanted to do their claims directly through the VA, would have to travel to one of those locations in order to get that assistance.
Right.
With the 59 counties of California, there are 56 VSOs currently, because Monterey and San Benito share a VSO, Inyo and Mono share a VSO, and currently Sierra does not have
one. So they don't have the funds to support their own office. So you guys travel.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. We focus on Shasta County, all the counties, veteran service officers, they try to focus on the residents within their county.
Sure.
However, if a county goes black for a few days waiting for a transition, another VSO is not going to turn that veteran away if they show up at their office.
Because you would still have access to their information?
We would at least have access through the federal side of their information, correct.
Okay. All right.
It's kind of important because I hear from people on a regular basis, well, I just went online, especially our younger folks. I went on the one end, we have the older people that are like, they a lot of times are not online people, so they're a little hamstrung because the VA system requires them to use apps and things like that.
Yes.
But then you have kind of a converse problem where you have the younger veterans get out and they're like, I don't need a stinking VSO. I'm going to file it myself. I'm going to go online and do it. Let's talk about how that works out.
So
a lot of times,
you know, I'll be honest, Aaron, it really depends on how their out processing goes.
That's true.
Because they have the armed forces across the country have the transitional assistance program, or TAPS. But TAPS really is good or bad, depending on where you're discharging from. So what TAPS is, it's a week or two of classes to kind of inform you about your benefits and that kind of thing as you're exiting before you actually get that final DD-214 in your hand. And in major locations such as San Diego, Fort Hood, Texas, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, these really large posts, their TAPS classes seem to be a lot better, more informative. They have a higher attendance rate. But if you get out someplace like myself, Fort McPherson, Georgia, we didn't even have a TAPS class when I got out. Now, granted, that was 1995, but it's developed way more now. Mm-hmm. But they didn't even offer transitional training, because as we all realize, they teach you how to be a sailor, a soldier, a Marine.
Right.
They don't teach you how to not be. And so that's kind of what, that's kind of what TAPS was developed for. But again, it's very territorial depending on where you're getting out. If you're getting out of a remote station or someplace that's a little less advanced, you know, you're not getting that same information. So a lot of these veterans, they jump on YouTube, they jump on TikTok, they jump on all these modern sites, and they're trying to pick up that information on their own. And there's some good information out there, and there's some bad information out there. We tend to pick up a lot of the ones that have filed their own claims, got a few denials on those claims. So once we attain access to their federal files, we can go back through all of those and review what VA's decisions were, why they were, what the missing information was. And then we're very successful at appealing those and coming back with positive decisions on those.
Good.
So, but it's more time eaten up through the VA system on having to appeal things versus getting them right the first time.
So you mentioned, the DD-214. Somebody walks in your office and says, "Hey, I'm a veteran." Does that form, do they have to have that in hand or no?
And what is it? Let's make sure we do that too.
So the DD-214 is the official discharge from all the branches of service. And it's not a deal breaker if they don't have it in hand. I get a lot of older veterans that say, you know, I've moved 14 times. I don't have my DD-214 anymore. We can help them order that from the National Archives.
Okay.
We can assist them with that. The VA is transitioning now to where we've got multiple storage locations, but we're all up to speed on those. A lot of veterans that were in the Air Force, a lot of their records are still at Randolph Air Force Base. A lot of Army veterans are still at the Army Personnel Command at Fort Knox, Kentucky. So we can help them navigate how to get that in hand. The biggest problem with the federal government right now, and I understand when it comes to this, Aaron, when it comes to this, Aaron, is my older veterans, they've gone to a login. You have to be able to have either ID.me or the gov, whatever the other one is.
ID.me. I think it's IRS is using it too.
Well, IRS, Social Security.
I think I ran into this
again
the other
day. And we'll get into another
day.
Problem with that down through this, but
let's take a quick break and we can mull over the problems with the federal government. You have 2 minutes to make your list. Pick the big things. Oh my God, that's a list too long to make. I'm sorry, I'm lying. Don't do that. Go get a snack. We'll be right back. And so just throw a shiv to my my friend Troy. We're gonna go out with a special song for him. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Tell you what you do. Call him a rave. Some douchebag rises up and overthrows his government. Diplomacy ain't working and ammo's all been spent. The world is in a crisis and the media's a curse. I'll tell you what to do. When it goes from bad to worse, call the Marine. Instead of 911, they're built to improvise, adapt, and overcome. When you're in knee deep and you're up shit's creek, you've tried everything. Tell you what you do. Call the Marine. Tell you what to do, baby. You
can. We hang out with people just like you. My hair's turning white, my neck's always been red, my collar's still blue, we've always been here, just trying to sing the truth to you, guess you could say, we've always been red, white, and blue.
Had to make up for the Marine song.
That's all right.
I know the Army guys love it when I play the Marine song. It's like, no, really good Army songs, though. Are there good Army songs?
There's a few of them out there.
I need you to send them to me. I need a better Army repertoire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do.
That's it. More Marine songs. Oh, man. Okay, so we were talking in the break that sometimes this information isn't what the men and women who have served need all the time. But a lot of times it's their relatives, their friends. You know, hey, I have a neighbor. They served. They've got all these problems. They don't know, you know, I want to help them. They can come to your office, too. They can't file a claim for them or anything like that.
Correct.
But if they were sent to your office, how does that help?
So what we'll do is we'll kind of sit down and give them the generic information.
Sure.
Excuse me. Okay. We'll get the generic information out to them. The really important part is we need to see that veteran face-to-face at least one time. That way we can identify that veteran appropriately. We know, that they exist, first of all.
Yeah. And you're filing a claim on their behalf.
Exactly.
Not, you know.
Exactly. And then, you know, once we see the veteran and we have a little conversation, if the veteran is, in a lot of cases, if the veteran's aging and it's hard to get them into our office, for instance, they're homebound or, mm-hmm. They're in an assisted living facility or something like that. We can do what's called a third party authorization for that friend or family member to be able to transport the paperwork back and forth between our office and that veteran, to get legal signatures and the types of things that we're going to need, to make that claim valid. If they're in an assisted living facility here locally, our office has an outreach officer that will
go there.
Yeah, that'll absolutely. Nice. Yeah. Austin Salisbury is our outreach officer and he will go to that assisted living facility and meet with that veteran on site. And then from there, we can do that paperwork transfer and all of that.
Are you guys pretty typical of your basic service office? I know a lot of the offices in different counties maybe only have one person in
right.
them.
We're That's blessed. Kind of a- yeah, we're blessed in Shasta County. And I put a shout out to our leadership. We've got five service officers that are in office, and then I've got my outreach coordinator, Austin. That can go out. He reaches out to Bernie. He reaches out to the outskirts of the county. Plus he does all the assisted living facilities. So that we can get to those folks that can't get to us. The
sure.
only thing that we can't do, and it's mostly for safety reasons, is private residence visits. That can get a little bit dicey. But if they're in a facility or
meet you at their local, whatever.
Yeah. You know, we're going to get to them. We're going to find a way to take care of that veteran. We even have a system where we can do telemeetings if they've got somebody that's techie enough to run it on their end to where we can meet with that veteran virtually and do virtual meetings. So one way or another, we're going to get to that veteran and make sure that whatever benefits are available, we're going to hook them up with those benefits and get that link going.
What's the time frame on something like that? I mean, I know I hear a lot of
horror stories. $64,000 question.
Yeah. What, how's that work?
So that's a great question, Bill. I will start off by saying it depends because there are several different types of claims. And it depends on the number of issues that you're claiming. So if you're claiming 13 disabilities, the VA is going to likely require you to have a compensation and pension exam for each one of those disabilities. Oh, wow. Those are all done through VA contractors in our area because we don't have a VA-run facility that can accommodate all of those. So once the claim goes out and it's in the hands of the VA. They're going to reach out to one of the four contractors that service the North State. And then we're kind of on their timeline to get all of that done. And then once those physicians, whether they're a nurse practitioner, a doctor, or whomever, once they do their examination, they send that information back to the VA. And then VA renders a decision if the exam is appropriate.
And are you notified at that point? I mean, or
we're able to track that entire thing.
Okay.
Through the federal systems. It's called the Veterans Benefits Maintenance System, or VBMS.
So you can tell them if the exam's been submitted.
Correct.
And VA has it. And
absolutely.
They're
we have full access to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So while that's going on, a more direct answer to your question, Bill, is what we're typically seeing on an average claim is anywhere from 4 to 8 months. It just depends on the types of conditions and how many conditions are being filed.
And if you can get the medical.
And if you can get the medical records and all of that.
Yeah.
Because
hot tip to anybody who's presently serving, if anything happens to you, get it on paper.
I have a sign on my desk, and it literally says, but have you documented it?
Mm-hmm. Get it on paper.
Yeah.
Send it home to your mm-hmm. folks. Have them put it in a safe place. And,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, going back later, I imagine, would be
sometimes a
nightmare.
Sometimes it can be.
Yeah. You know, especially.
Well, especially if it wasn't documented at the time.
Well.
Correct.
Combat. So you have that issue. The other issue is, at times, I might have been, had crossed paths with somebody who was damaged by the military.
Correct.
And magically, those records disappeared. I mean, who would have thought? So they claimed none of those things ever happened. But then you go back and you need what they call buddy statements.
Correct.
But you only knew the guy's name was, we called him Gunny.
Gunny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, how many of those are there?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like gangsters.
I've got a perfect example of that. I had a veteran that had filed their own claim as they were leaving the Air Force. They were seriously injured while they were serving in the Middle East. They were sent to Walter Reed. They finally got out of there. And when they filed their own claim, they mistakenly sent all of their original records
Ooh.
With that claim to the VA. And all of a sudden, they were gone. So the claim got denied. And we were able to track through the federal systems, we were able to track that there was a notation that they had received those records, but they never got uploaded into this veteran's file. So we advised this veteran to reach out. He was a newer exit from the military. Reach out to his peers that he served with, that fortunately he still had contact with, get buddy letters. And he brought back 5 buddy letters, and one of them actually produced a photograph of all 5 of them standing around his hospital bed.
Oh, there you go.
So obviously we won that claim in the end. Even though the VA had misplaced all of his records.
Misplaced? You're so kind.
It's political correctness, Aaron.
Oh, but we're in the cone of no political correctness. Yes, they accidentally misplaced it.
Yeah, well.
Mm-hmm.
So they, ultimately we won that claim. The veteran was beside himself when he first walked into our office because he couldn't understand after spending, time in Germany and then in the hospital and then being transferred to Walter Reed and spending another month there.
But they couldn't come
They couldn't come up with his records.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible.
But unfortunately, when he left the military, he took his original claim or his original paperwork with him, and that's what he sent to the VA. And it came up missing through the systems.
Yeah. Well, in defense of the system.
Look at you, Bill.
They have to process the you know, Walter Reed and these military hospitals have to process probably thousands and thousands of records.
Oh, I can only imagine.
You know, thousands of patients and one little fumble and.
Well, and the other thing to take into account is that for the VA, they have the evidence intake center. It's one location.
Isn't it for Wisconsin?
Janesville, Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Ryan's old district.
But it is a single facility that intakes all evidence for every claim that is ever filed in the country and our territories. Mm-hmm. Everything goes through there.
That's in one location.
That's in one location.
That's like
one
central processing. The scanning facility.
It's the scan center.
God, if anything ever happened to that place, look out.
Yeah.
It's probably in the cloud.
Yeah. So, you know, I can understand where things could potentially get misplaced when they're taking in the amount of paperwork that they do.
Oh, yeah, I can't even imagine.
Monthly, weekly, or daily process. Mm-hmm.
I guess we should also probably tell, like, I was, you know, I'm always thinking like, well, so maybe you don't know anything about this and you're starting from scratch. So the VA is a term we throw around a lot, the VA. Like, it's just like one thing.
Yeah.
And just hot tip, anybody who thinks that Secretary Collins, God bless him, is going to run out there and like fix it all magically, it's a north of 400,000 employees.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not sure which monumental task he would take up that would fix the whole thing in one fell swoop. But VA is multiple things. So you have VHA, Veterans Health Administration. That's the VA, right? So there's the medical side. Then you have VBA, Veterans Benefits Administration. So that's the claim side that you're interfacing with all the time.
Claims and education.
Yep. And, oh yeah, right. We should go through that a little bit. And then you have cemetery.
Correct.
So it's multiple. I mean, they're almost like different.
And they're not automatically linked together by one magical computer system.
And they're absolutely not linked together.
They talk to each other.
No, they don't. Mm. No. So how much do they not talk to each other is if you are a veteran in, Northern California, say north of Sacramento, and you go to visit relatives in San Diego and you have some sort of a thing and you go to the local VA facility because you, I don't know, whatever.
You're on the beach, you twist an ankle.
Yeah, there
and,
you
go.
I'm having trouble coming up with an injury.
No, you're all right. but San Diego may not even be able to recognize you because all of your records are housed within the Northern California VA Healthcare Administration system.
Hmm.
Those can get transferred, but that's a process.
Right. It doesn't happen overnight. You know, you're traveling and, you know, you're in Ohio for a wedding. Something happens.
Correct.
But the thing that's crazy. And so not to say that this is normal because it is crazy at this point. We always have to remember, like, all these agencies started in the analog era.
Oh, yeah.
Like when we all started.
Mm-hmm.
So there were no computers. Then they had, you know, the giant computer. Then they had, you know, it's gone through iterations, but a lot of them wrote their own software over the years and have their own, quote, IT department. So they didn't go – there was no Microsoft. There was no off the shelf.
Yeah.
So they're all operating in these little silos of information, and they're not integrated yet. So unlike Medicare
–
where you go anywhere in the country, show them your Medicare card, and you have access to healthcare.
Correct.
VA doesn't work that way.
Nope.
Are there plans to join that, or is it even possible?
They have had plans. Scott Blackburn, that we interviewed, he was the undersecretary during Obama, I think. It's been a while ago.
Yeah.
We interviewed him, and he was the guy who was going to do that, put that all together, and then his term ran out. And he was a great guy. His daughter actually is an Olympic hopeful in figure skating, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Shout out to Scott Blackburn. So anyway, good guy, and they have been working on it. But, you know, it's a little bit like, if you think about it, you can't remodel your whole house while you live in it, you know,
right.
At the same time. You can't tear apart every room simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they really kind of have to do.
Yeah, you can't just shut down what already exists
and
while you're
rebuilding.
Process. Yeah,
right.
While you're rebuilding a new singular system, You have to kind of piecemeal it in, and then you've got to test it and make sure it runs and runs appropriately.
Right.
Before you can launch it.
Yeah, I can't imagine how you would even start a project like that with that many different
I was kind of hoping the Doge guys could, you know, build that in the background because that is their expertise.
Yeah.
And I know that they are working on this, but it's it really is a need. It's a huge need, and I think would make your world a lot easier.
Oh.
From a, I mean, can you imagine?
Drastically.
People get out of the military and DOD computers talk to VA computers and you guys could get the records without doing a paper chase?
Well, in a lot of the branches now, with our young service members that are getting out, all the records used to go to the National Records Archives, which is a non-VA entity.
In St. Louis.
In St. Louis.
Yeah.
And then when you filed a claim, the VA would have to reach out to the National Records Archives and retrieve those, which is a great thought back in the day before all of the technological advances that we have now. The problem is that the VA is working a program now, or the national government as a whole, is working a program to transfer all of those new records directly into the VA's record management system as you exit the service, whatever branch.
Mm-hmm. That's super
but
helpful.
When I get veterans that come in that are Korea era, Vietnam era, those records are still housed at the National Records Archives. So by the time VA gets them, mind you, a lot of them were stored on microfiche. For those of you that don't know, that was a really, really old photographic way of doing things. And they're illegible in a lot of cases. Well, because if you remember the old microfiche films, they'd have hairlines in them and
don't you remember going to the library and having to use all that stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we have to take a really quick break, so you have 2 minutes to look up microfiche. I'd like to give everybody a chore during the commercials here. You've got something to do, tide you over. If you're listening to the archive, of course, we cut that part out, so just forget it, because just listen to the songs. We'll be right back. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You can bet that I stand ready when the wolf growls at the door. Hey, I'm solid. Hey, I'm steady. Yeah, I'm true down to the core, and I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost, I know the sacrifice. Oh, and I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asking me, I'll bear that cross with honor, cause freedom don't come free. I'm an American soldier, and I'm beside my brothers and my sisters, I will proudly take a stand. When liberty's in jeopardy, I will always do what's right. I'm out here on the front lines, sleep in peace tonight. American soldier,
and I'm proud to be on this peaceful piece of property. I'm on sacred ground and I'm in the best company. I'm thankful for those, thankful for the things I've done. I can rest in peace. I'm one of the chosen ones. I made it to Arlington.
Yeah, in all seriousness, can't forget that part.
No.
At all. So, kind of put a little word out to all the people who have relatives, friends, and acquaintances who have been lost in service and who have served and are gone.
God bless them.
Yep. So, let's go back to the National Archives, by the way. In St. Louis, I may have happened to had a phone call with the archivist at the St. Louis Archives probably 10 years ago. And there were some records that were being sought by somebody who was injured in the Army, by the Army. And those records could never be found. And it had already been 30 years. I mean, it had been a while. And I called periodically on behalf of this gentleman. And I finally get this different guy, his different voice, you know, and he's like, well, I've been here longer than anybody else at that time. And I was like, okay. I go, well, what about the fire? Could they have burned up in this fire you guys had? He goes, let me tell you about the fire. Okay. He says, yeah, well, the fire was in 1973, so your guy got out in 1978, so there's no way it burned up in the fire. I was like, oh, well, that's exciting. He goes, yeah, but there's more. He said, when that fire started, it was started by the employees of the National Archives. This is a little-known fact. He goes, we don't publicize it, but they got behind. And the files had piled up, and they thought if they just burned a few of them up, they would have less to file. And it got away from them and burned, you know, part of the building down. So it was in – I don't have my note with me. Darn it. What was I thinking? But it was in 1973. So if a member – a service member has been discharged post-1973, there is no way you're – records burned up in the fire. So please do not take that for an excuse. It is not possible.
Correct. And we see that off and on.
Well, the other thing is they burned up all the Army records for people who were discharged prior to 1959.
Yeah.
So if you were discharged in the Army post-1959, even though the fire was in 1973, your records still exist.
Oh, really?
Correct. And Air Force was only letters Hubbard through Z. So Hubbard through Z prior to 1973 burned up. So the number of Army veterans whose records burned up are like infinitesimal because you would have had to have been discharged prior to 1959.
Right.
So if there is a fire thing with the St. Louis Archives, you need to get more serious about that and do not accept that as the as your first, you know, your
first
answer.
Well, and also that kind of gives you an idea how many records are stored there.
Lord, yes.
Huge fire and tiny little bit of certain branches was burned up. I mean.
But I do hear from people, no Navy records. So if they tell you your Navy records were burned up in the archive,
right.
Epic fail. So you hear from people, you know, oh, well, I tried to get my records. They were burned up. I'm like, wait, what is your name? What branch are you in? What year? And you can narrow it down whether or not that's real.
Correct.
And you should.
No, you should never take no as gospel when we're dealing with the VA, the National Archives. Never take no as, oh, I guess I'm just out of luck.
Right.
Because there are other ways and other facts out there that can help you get what it is you're looking for.
Right.
And that's super important to know. So – there's like a million routes we could go. Talk about the education part of it, though. We did kind of stepped around that earlier.
Yeah, it's just one of the benefits that we assist our veterans with. So the veteran themselves is entitled to their GI Bill as long as they have an honorable discharge. They lose their GI Bill benefits if it is less than the word honorable. If it's a general under honorable conditions, they are no longer entitled to their GI Bill. If it's less than that, you know, other than honorable discharge, bad conduct, those just delete your benefits for education. So we can help the veteran navigate the VA system to apply for their education benefits. The other less known fact is if a veteran is service connected at 100% disabled, their spouse and their children younger than age 27 are also entitled to federal educational benefits. Mm. It's called DEA, Dependents Educational Assistance. Sorry, I had to go back through my own. I had to go back through my own mental archives there for a second.
Back to acronym 101.
Yeah, and you know, we can help them apply for that as well. The state of California has a education benefit for the dependents of a veteran, that is more of an income needs based. It's not based on the veteran's household income. It's simply based on the student's income. It's called the California College Tuition Fee Waiver. And ultimately what it does is that any state college or university, CCCs, UCs, or CSUs, it waives the per unit cost for that university.
Oh, wow.
Which is a huge, hugely popular benefit for our students. And it was just last year that they changed the income threshold from the federal poverty line to the California poverty line, which is about $6,000 difference annually. More like $8,000.
California is making sure that we're poorer, so.
Yeah. So, and that, it used to be much more difficult because for the state of California residents to run on the national poverty line, good Lord, you'd have to be almost homeless or basically homeless to qualify in California for the national poverty line. So they changed that regulation in 2023, I believe it was. And now it's the state poverty line that qualifies. So, but those are the three that we mostly work with on those. And then there's also,
do they have to have a rating in order to get the educational benefit?
For the California College Tuition Fee Waiver, the veteran can be anywhere from 0 to 100% service connected disabled. And for those that don't know, yes, zero is an actual percentage. It's just a non-compensable percentage.
So they'll rate you, but they won't pay you.
Correct. For hearing loss is the most common one that you see.
Isn't that always like 10%?
I'm sorry?
Isn't hearing?
No, hearing loss
That's
can
it.
Be.
You're in the doghouse, Troy. Marine songs only from now on.
Hearing loss can be rateable at 0%.
Yeah.
And basically what that means is, yes, there is damage to your hearing that was caused by your service in the military. However, it has not reached a threshold to meet a compensable rating of 10%.
Hmm.
So I have a lot of veterans that have 0% for hearing loss, a lot of them. But as they get older and hearing diminishes, they can always file for increases on that as their hearing gets worse.
You can get an increase for your decrease?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
I actually had a veteran that came in that was rated 0% almost from the time he got out of the military. And he'd been out 30 plus years.
Wow.
We went through his records. We said, oh, you're already rated for hearing loss. And to me, that's a no harm, no foul claim. Because now he's 30, 40 years older than he was when he got his original rating. So we filed the claim and came back. He's now 100% service connected for hearing loss and could have been rated higher throughout the years. Maybe not all the way to 100, but, you know, gradually increased over the years if they had known.
It can change as time goes on.
Absolutely.
You can get a different rating.
Absolutely. If a condition deteriorates over the years, it can be increased to a higher rating.
And is that true with any of the medical?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
The thing to watch out for is if it does improve and you file the claim, they can also reduce that rating decision.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's where a lot of folks come in to our office. Well, I filed this claim. And now they want to reduce me. And
because they filed it themselves.
Correct.
And you would have said, not your best plan.
Well, and a lot of people get frustrated because we ask for them to get some medical evidence before we file the claim. Mm-hmm. Because we can go through the regulations and we can kind of gauge where that's going to come in. Hearing loss is easy because it's all math.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's subjective to what the audiogram spits out when you go through your audiology examination. Whatever the numbers are, we can calculate those numbers. We can figure out exactly what that rating is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Before we ever file the claim.
Right.
So people get frustrated because we ask them, you know, you're already rated 40%. let's go get a hearing test before we jump on doing this. We'll put in what's called an intent to file, which saves that
date. Right.
Mm-hmm. So that they're not losing time in retro pay while they're getting that other hearing test. Because if they're going to go to the VA to get it, that may be 3 months down the road before they actually get an appointment.
Right.
But if we file that intent to file, that saves the date from the day they run our office and gives us 364 days to file the claim.
Yeah.
And it still pays retroactively back to the date of that intent to file.
Hmm.
So I try to err on the side of caution, better safe than sorry, because it's harder to fight a proposal to reduce an issue than it is to get it right the first time.
And that's, I guess, why I really did want to do this. And just fair warning, we're in the last 2 minutes here. Can you believe it? Wow. I knew this would – I told you an hour isn't going to be long enough. We'll have to do this some more. But it is – it, you know, I just – can't stress to people enough, if you have questions, if you're trying to help somebody who isn't having any success filing a claim, they really need to go to their county veteran service office.
Absolutely, 100%.
And have you guys evaluate that and see maybe how you can – you deal with the claims all the time.
That's what we do for a living.
It's like anything else. You know, we can all – okay, we can all fix our own plumbing, but how does that usually turn out?
Right. Yeah. For those that don't know, the county veteran service officers too, and I'll make this really quick.
No, it's all right.
We are fully accredited representatives. In other words, we've been through multiple academies. We've taken multiple legal exams to even get to where we are. So, you know, John Smith on the street that says, oh, I got my claim through successfully and I can get yours through. Not necessarily the case.
And you know, the last thing here, in the last 15 seconds, do not hire a lawyer first.
No.
Go to the County Veteran Service Office, and then if it can't be unscrambled from there, you may need an attorney. But if you go to an attorney first and you get a retro pay award, you will owe them. Troy Payne, thank you so much for coming in. We will do this again. So the County Veteran Service Office has been our focus the second hour. We'll do this again.
Thank you.
Listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I thank God for my life, and for the stars and stripes. May freedom forever fly. Let it ring. Salute the ones who die, the ones that give their lives, so we don't have to sacrifice all the things we love, like our chicken fries and cold beer on a Friday night, a pair of jeans that fit just right, and the radio. Works.